This is Reimagining Higher Education, your go-to podcast with remarkable education leaders sharing personal stories from their experience in and around the sector, including reflection and hope for progress in the sector. With your host, Professor Judith Sachs, former PVC Learning and Teaching at the University of Sydney, Deputy Vice Chancellor and Provost at Macquarie University, and Special Advisor in Higher Education at KPMG, and now Chief Academic Officer at Studiosity. Welcome.
Today I'm talking to the Vice Chancellor and President of the University of Sydney, a very complex institution, but also an interesting career that you've had as both running very complex organisations. And when I thought back upon your experience, you had a life of being an educator in various forms, started life as a teacher, ran the most complex bureaucracy in education, the New South Wales Department of Education, now running Sydney University, and then in between there was being the CEO and Managing Director of the ABC. But can you talk to us today about how you came to be the person and leader that you are, but also some of the insights that you've had throughout this journey? So to start that conversation, I invited you to bring an object that represents your leadership journey. And so why don't we start with that, and I look forward to hearing and seeing what you bring.
Yeah, well, look, thanks, Judith, and good to be with you and good to have the conversation. I noticed some of my Vice Chancellor colleagues brought their mobile phones. I've gone even further analog, but simplistic, which is my blank pad of paper, which is always with me. And I think there are some reasons for that. Early on in my career, Fred Hilmer was my boss. We were both working in media. We both ended up running universities. But one of the things that Fred always said was paper is cheap. And this idea of take a blank piece of paper, understand your own thinking better, test your ideas, look for the connections, and explore your thinking, I think was what he encouraged me to do. And I was reflecting on, you know, Kahneman's thinking fast and slow, and something a blank piece of paper in a very kind of fast track life, I suppose, where your agenda is often set and your diary is often full, and you can be, at times you can feel like it's writing you rather than you're writing it. The prospect to sit down and be slow and to think and to write using a blank piece of paper I found quite important. Now, there's another practice that I kind of stumbled across some years ago now, and when I think things are going well for me, I'm doing it, is this practice called morning pages, where you're encouraged to sit down and write three pages almost at the very start of the day. Julia Cameron talks about this in her writing on creativity, and I found that to be very useful, actually. You sit down, blank piece of paper, what's on your mind, what are you thinking about, any reflections, any insights? It's quite a meditative practice, and I suppose it can clear your minds on things, but as good writing often does, it will also bring insights to you that you didn't know you had through that practice. Now, what do you then do with that? I shred it, actually. I'm not trying to keep a diary. I'm not trying to keep a log. I don't want to go back and read the 2016 entries, but I do find that quite a useful way of starting the day. And I think a lot of my interests in my career has been involved in writing, certainly as a journalist, great time on the board of the Sydney Writers Festival, love reading and love writing, actually. And so there's something about the blank piece of paper and all that it offers to the way you think, the way you reflect, the way you engage. I think that's been pretty important for my whole leadership career, because of what I hope. I've been leading large, complex organisations for just about 18 years now, and I still feel that I'm learning so much about leadership and how to lead and how to get the best out of people and how to take organisations to places they need to be. And in order to do that, I think you need to be deeply reflective. And the blank pad of paper helps you do that, I think.
That's the most interesting set of reflections, because to me, you're talking about discipline in thinking, but it's also an opportunity to put things down on paper, to see what they look like, and then either enact them or get rid of them. So I I really like that. And I'm sure others will take it up when they listen to your podcast. Talk to us about what was your journey as a learner like? What was university like for you?
Well, look, you know, it was, you know, the transformational opportunity, I suppose, and helped me explore ideas and areas of interest and grow up a bit too. You know, I often reflect that I think almost the most profound thing was almost the friends and connections that I made. I met my wife, Bryony, on Carr's Law Lawn at the University of Sydney. There's no longer a Carr's Law Lawn at the University of Sydney, but our marriage has endured. Great, you know, I think our lifelong friends are the friends we made at university. But the areas of interest that I developed as a student, I think thinking in and around politics and how you bring about change in a society, thinking through the role of media in that and my interest in media and journalism and I suppose technology at the intersection, these are all things that came to bear that I had opportunities to explore as an undergraduate at the University of Sydney. I then went and did a postgraduate study in public policy, both at Sydney and then overseas. So the opportunity to find those seeds that spark in you and then to explore them in greater depth, I think that's been wonderful. And it's interesting, as we sometimes say to our students, that those who have the transformational experience, often four things are happening for them. They get more and more interested in their studies over time. They make their friends. They have broadening experiences. And they find mentors and guides and coaches who can shape them along the way. And I was reflecting on, you know, my own experience, you know, when I was being talked to and having conversations with the university about being Vice Chancellor, the fact that I could go back to a professor who taught me when I was an undergraduate, you know, 40 plus years ago, who's still an emeritus professor at the university, and say, is this a crazy idea? Can I test this thinking on you? I just showed that, in a sense, that package of broadening opportunities, I was in a position to avail myself of that. And that's what you want for every student at the university now, even though the university is much, much bigger than it was when I was an undergraduate student, as is the case for nearly all of Australian universities these days.
One of the things that struck me about you as a Vice-Chancellor is that you are talking about students and the student experience a lot. And at a place like Sydney, because it's so large, the metrics that measure student experience indicate that students aren't happy. So tell me what's behind your thinking to enhance the student experience, and what will success look like for you to be confident that your values and aspirations around students have been realised?
Yeah, I think we do need to take it seriously. I think it's absolutely part of the social contract of the university. At the very core, the very essence of any university, even a research-intensive university, is the fact that students are there, that students are learning. And yes, we're creating knowledge and we're sharing knowledge. And at the University of Sydney, we talk about building experiences that develop leadership for good. And so I think it's a false dichotomy to me that says you're either going to be outstanding at research or outstanding at teaching, and you're not outstanding at both. And I don't think that's a conversation they're having at the great global universities. I think at Harvard and Stanford and Cambridge and Oxford, the student experience is very central to what they do, as well as the research experience. And I think, you know, one of the challenges we've got in the model of Australian higher education as it's emerged post-Dawkins, and the dependence we have on being strong in research and that being acknowledged internationally, is that this loop that says do well in the rankings, attract international students that provide you with the income to be great in research, to do well in the rankings, that loop that can happen keeps the student experience outside that and the domestic student experience outside that. I think it's just central to our social contract. The reason we have universities is to educate and give young people a transformational experience and to equip them for the roles that they will play in society. And we need to listen carefully to what they are telling us about their experience and engage and respond to that. It's curious, you know, as someone who spent a lot of my time outside the sector, you don't fling the customer word around universities too much because people don't necessarily like that. I understand that. But I think we are partners with students in their learning. And as with any partnership, you want students to think, as any partner, that this is valuable, this is worthwhile, that they are getting the very best out of it, and that we are paying a lot of attention and respect to the feedback that they give. And look, I think we have brilliant teachers at the University of Sydney. We have some outstanding facilities. And it's interesting, even if you look at the feedback they give us, these approval ratings in the 70%, you know, a lot of politicians would kill for approval ratings in the 70%, but we need to do better. And we need to pay more attention to it. And I think there is a collective efficacy that comes to bear with the Vice Chancellor and the senior leadership team and all the deans and the heads of schools all understanding that student experience is a top priority, and we should be able to focus on it without trading off the other areas that are also very important. We need to think about what pedagogy is like in this era of technology, how young people learn best today, how we create environments where they learn from each other and connect with each other, as well as the sage on the stage, and to think through what the modes of delivery are now that are most engaging, and to be in genuine partnership with our students to create environments where they learn best and get the best out of the university environment. I think that's absolutely vital. The other thing I feel this kind of burden about is, I suppose, to reflect on my experience as a student and the experience of students today. I was in the era of free education, you know, post-Whitlam. Students are now paying significant money under the HECS scheme as it's allocated now. When I was a student at the University of Sydney, some of the cheapest accommodation that you'd find anywhere in the city wrapped around the university, that's no longer the case now. There are very few three-bedroom terraces at Glebe renting for $40 a week these days. It costs students more, and we need to be conscious of what they're paying. But the real thing they're paying is for the most wonderful years of their life. They are free and liberated from the burdens of school. They are open to the opportunities of the world. We get them at that transformational moment, and we can't waste their time. They should be saying to us, this was the best and most wonderful thing I could possibly do. And they should feel at their time as students, and then increasingly as they look back as students, that this just was wonderful. And that's what our offer has got to be.
So how do we support that? Because I too was the beneficiary of a free university education, and I did work, but that was so that I could travel overseas. So I didn't work because I had to live. So how can we, for many students, the relationship they have with the university is purely transactional. So how do we create the possibility for that connection, relationships, growing up, and everything that involves in, you know, testing the boundaries? How do we do that in universities now when there are so many competing demands on students' finances, times, and energy?
I think that's the central question, and there's no easy and straightforward answer to that. But there are a number of things I think you know to be right. You know, one of the reasons we've invested heavily in scholarships for low SES students in the last couple of years at the university is that I think when it comes to access, and particularly students from low SES backgrounds, disadvantaged schools, for them to come to the university with the almost the lack of financial support that others might have, you've actually got to intervene and help close that financial gap so that they don't feel as compelled that they have to be working almost effectively full-time as well as trying to study full-time. That just perpetuates disadvantage. The other thing I think we need to do is make it easier for them to connect with each other at bigger universities. So we're putting more money into clubs and societies where people can find their tribe, find their kindred spirits. Because I think actually once they're not as alone and on their own and they find their people, then the university is more likely to be a gathering place. There's some pretty straightforward things as well. I mean, we're looking carefully about what's our food provision on campus. You know, how welcoming and accepting are we to make it easy for people to stay after class and stay into the evening? And do we have a great supply of affordable food, high quality food, food that represents the diversity of our community? Because we all know that, you know, to gather over a meal, to break bread together, to talk with each other, that's where a lot of those deeper connections take place. Whereas if it's transactional, as you point out, and if you know, someone said to me, there's a pretty good system that's been set up by the New South Wales government called Service New South Wales. And it's where you register your car, change your driver's license, do a whole series of things, but it really works well. People are sometimes surprised at how well it works. But the feeling about Service New South Wales, the test is how quickly can you get out with a relevant piece of paper? We've got to make sure our universities don't turn into Service New South Wales, you know. How quickly can you get out with a relevant piece of paper rather than I want to spend as much of my time here, because the more and more time I spend here and gather here and connect here, the richer my experience of university life is. So I think more attention to the amenity of university, the welcoming nature of the physical environment, and then the stimulus and the creation of spaces where people are likely to gather and helping people find the commonality and common interest. I think that's significant. The other thing I'd say, I think we're wrestling with somewhat. One of the things, I arrived at the university in the middle of 2021. So COVID was mid-flight. And there's a lot of online teaching going on. And when classes opened up again, you know, I suppose I had a view that said, oh, well, you know, the lecture theatres will be full and, you know, back they'll all come. But part of my discovery was, well, before COVID, once classes got up online and if not live streamed, then recorded for students to catch up on later, which I think was done in a view of serving students and giving them more flexibility, that many students were electing not to come and they would watch, they'd watch the video of the lecture. And some students would say to me, you know, it just allows me to pause and rewind and make sure I got the point. Others would admit to me, it allowed them to watch the lecture at double speed and spend half the time engaging with the class. But whatever the reason, being there in person didn't seem to be as compelling. And I think, you know, this is a real challenge for the way we structure the teaching and learning experience in this environment. I think what we can see from COVID and agree on is that we do learn better together. There's something about coming together and learning and sometimes having someone else frame the question that had been nagging at the back of your mind that you hadn't framed yourself, being able to talk and work with people before class and after class, learning from each other as well as learning from the teacher. But how do you structure the learning experience so it really does reward, does make it worthwhile for you to get up and go to university and go to that class? Because once you're at university, all these other benefits are likely to accrue as well. So, you know, I think it does challenge how we are structuring classes, how we're structuring the engagement so that you really do feel that you're missing out if you're not there and you're prioritising the opportunity to lean in and engage that learning experience.
I don't disagree with anything you've said, but we both know universities are slow to change. And so they are tribal, they're territorial. And, you know, some people say they move with glacial speed. How, as a leader, because you've come from a completely different set of backgrounds, completely set of drivers and assumptions, which for me is enormously exciting. How are you going to sort of get that collective energy to drive your vision, your aspirations for what I think is a fair, equitable, transformative experience?
I think part of it, and if, you know, I think I sometimes learn a bit about my leadership when I look back and reflect on how I've led rather than always having a blueprint, you know, etched out, ready to go. I think one of the things we've done at the university since I've started is we've had good engagement around the university that we want to build together. And we've talked a lot about what are the hallmarks of a great global university and almost done a gap analysis about where we are now from where we need to be. So I think we've got a shared aspiration. And one of those shared aspirations in this context is a transformational student experience. And I think reflecting on where we fall short together as an executive team, the deans actively engaged in this, a senior leadership group of a couple of hundred people who I regularly convene at the university, I think it's shared ambition that gives rise to effective efficacy, collective efficacy, and in a sense, a shared understanding about what we've got to do. But every now and again, you've got to, I'm not a great table thumping kind of leader, but every now and again, I think you've got to just get people together and say, this isn't good enough. And on the last quilt results, I got our senior group together. I said, this isn't good enough. I need a blueprint this month on what we're going to do. And one of the things I found, frankly, about this is that as you dive into the data, and the university can be quite rich in data, but as you really engage, you can see patterns and trends. You know, you can see things that you need to work on, and they will be things that apply in medicine and engineering and science and business and arts. And, okay, so what together are we going to do? And you can actually learn from what others have done and really engage. So I think there is a sense of shared ambition, clear-eyed assessment of the gap, a sense of prioritization. I think one of the things we're still wrestling with, frankly, is the ambition is significant. The tasks that then might trigger could be are many. Can you do it all at once? Can you afford to do it all at once? Not just even in terms of budget, but in terms of the load that it puts on the time of people and the capability pressure that it puts on the organization. So can you then sequence and prioritize what the work is and where the greatest benefit comes in the work in order to get this, in order to make change? Now, I am confident we can change things, but it's going to have to be a deliberative course of action to do it rather than simply drifting on. And I think one of the interesting things about our strategy process at Sydney is that we're all busy. The university is always busy. The operational demands are very many. It's a large, complex place. But it's only by pausing and thinking what is most important and what do we want to achieve together that I think we're getting the knitting together of the actions that come behind the ambitions to get things done.
We often talk about challenges facing higher education, but there are lots of opportunities. So what opportunities do you see, particularly around the latest reforms through the Accord? And where will your priorities lie?
I think the Accord team, when the report landed, it just put a spotlight on the great challenges that face Australian higher education. And I think one of those is that really it's chronically underfunded and there are significant distortions that come into the higher education sector as a consequence of that. And I'm a great supporter of international students for numbers of reasons. We attract brilliant students from all around the world who come to Sydney. They are fabulous. In many ways, great research contribution. But when I do graduations in China and I see those students who've gone back and they are working in, you know, big four firms, they have their own startups, they're working in the banks, they're working at government-run enterprises. And I think, where are they going to be in 20 years' time? It's very exciting. And I think of them as being great friends of Australia, supporters of Australia, and the public diplomacy soft power benefit of that, I think we are constantly underestimating. But I'll admit there's a dependence on them financially for Australia's research system to work, which was never intended when international students were, allowed into Australia, full fee-paying international students. And governments of both sides have actually stepped away from the table when it comes to funding, allowed international students to carry that burden. When I was a student at the University of Sydney, more than 90% of the funding came from the federal government. Now, directly, it's less than 30%. And so you've got a distorted funding system. And I think it is amazing that despite that underfunding and the low levels of R&D investment in Australia, that Australia has 9 universities in the global top 100. I think that's astonishing. Mm-hmm. But there's great things that we need to do. I support the equity and access question that is being strongly advanced by Minister Clare, and certainly what we're doing here at the University of Sydney with our My Sydney Scholarships. We are denying the transformational opportunity of an education at the University of Sydney for too high barriers that we put on entry and too many students self-select away from us. And what we can see with these students coming in on My Sydney Scholarships is once you get them in and wrap the right support around them, their academic results are as good or better than the cohort that we've been traditionally taking in. So I think access is an important question. That we are delivering the skills mix we need for the future economy, I think, is significant. I think one of the things that the Accord is silent on, it puts this kind of vast figure of the increased pool of students who will need at universities, a very significant intake in university participation rate. But I think quieter on how are we going to absorb those students into either current universities or what are we thinking about new institutions? The University of Sydney, with 75,000 students, is one of the largest universities in the world in the global top 100. How big are we happy for universities to be? And what does that mean for student experience over time? So I think that's an important area. I think on the Tertiary Education Commission, I would welcome a structure that allows a longer term thinking around the work that we do that is very long-term and future thinking. There's no more future thinking sector than education. We are preparing students for the work that they will do for a generation or two ahead. I think too much of the policy settings in higher education over the last couple of decades have chopped and changed with changes of ministers, changes of government, changes at senior levels of the public sector. I think even senior folks in the Federal Department of Health would say they've had a hollowing out of expertise when it comes to higher education policy. And so if, in fact, you can get a Tertiary Education Commission that brings a longer-term perspective about what is most important in the nation's interest beyond the short-term electoral cycle, I think that would be a very positive thing too if we could bring that to bear.
Returning to students, given how we started off this conversation, if there was one thing that you could change or do at the moment to support students to be successful, what would that be?
I'm going to graciously take a question and then and suggest you tell me what are the two things I'd do, because I think there are two things that are quite at different ends, I think. One on the equity question. I think goes to student accommodation. And, you know, I've had some wonderful conversations with students. We have students on the My Sydney Scholarships who travel 4 hours to get to the university and back each day. They're living on the northern parts of the Central Coast, some way out in southwestern Sydney, and it's long train trips and connections and the like. I'd love to be able to provide a lot more accommodation for students or scholarships for students to take advantage of accommodation offerings far closer to the campus. I think that's almost like a hidden point of disadvantage. And if you've got a student who is a 10-minute walk away from class or a 15-minute bus trip compared to someone who's doing those longer hours, I think the exhausting nature of that, the inhibitor for that student to actually want to have to come in every day and do that commute, the discipline that they have to show. I mean, some of these students who've done this, who I've chatted with, they are incredible. They are so organized. They knew, use every minute well. But I do think the accommodation question and the price of accommodation close to campus or closer to campus is an issue I want to fix. The other one I think we're wrestling with extensively is what does it mean to be providing an education in a generative AI world, and what is our responsibility for every student around this? It's interesting. The clearly a failed policy measure under the previous government was job-ready graduates, right? It distorted how the HEC scheme operates. It sent some very perverse signals into the marketplace. It didn't have the policy outcomes that the federal government then hoped for. It hasn't worked, and I think there's a unanimity in voice around that. But I thought the very framing of it, your job-ready graduates, it implied that what universities were really designed to do was to help prepare graduates for their first job. Well, I think we are wanting to prepare students for their first job, particularly if they're teachers and doctors and nurses. But we recognise the learning will continue through their careers. And what we really want to be preparing is career-ready graduates. And part of the career-ready resilience is a recognition that over a career, many things will change. And do you have the capability to not just have learned at university, but to be a lifelong learner, the ability to continue to learn and master and have the confidence to engage with the new and to come to an authoritative positioning with the new so that you can still have agency through your career, no more so than with generative AI now, that we need to think about how we equip students to use AI effectively in their learning as a great aid to student learning. And some of our students, we had a group of students come to our university senate to explain how they were using AI to prepare for lectures, to summarize afterwards, to master key skills, to prepare for exams and assignments. So that was a great education. But then how we make our assessments resilient through this process and how you use AI in assessments. So that's all one thing. But the most important outtake beyond all of those things might well be, we just know that AI or iterations from where we are with AI will be a hallmark of almost every career for the duration of their careers. So are we giving them the skills and the confidence and the capability to be able to wrestle in and address the new? I'm almost as confident about what AI can do for education as for any other sector. Because I think, you know, one of the things, I can see this through my background in schooling, you can quite easily assess what a student knows and doesn't know. What's a lot harder to assess is, why doesn't the student understand that? Why are those questions wrong? Why is that an area of underdeveloped learning? And the sources of that can be very, very different. And the ability of AI to be a sophisticated diagnostic tool to say the reason Judith doesn't understand this isn't that she missed last week or the week before, but 2 years ago, she didn't master this important foundational area. And we can diagnose that, and then we can work with the diagnostic tool to help Judith address those areas that lays a far stronger foundation for the rest of her learning. So give me accommodation, give me AI mastery, and I'm pleased with what we can offer our students more.
Two last questions. What advice would you give current students? I mean, every year you go to many graduations, you see them walk across the stage in the Great Hall, and it's a time of great joy. And for some reason, something terrifying happens to them when they walk up the stairs, walk across the stage of the Great Hall. And I went to many hundreds of Sydney University graduations while I was there. But what advice would you give to those students in light of everything else that you've said this morning?
Yes, I think, you know, one of the pieces of career advice, if you like, that I suppose I've seen and developed over the years, both in times in education, but actually as working leader of the organisation, is to oddly not to say that you shouldn't have career ambitions, but not to be distracted by those ambitions. If I think of my career, I sometimes will reflect on the insight of Kierkegaard. You know, to paraphrase him, where he talks about how life can only be lived moving forward, but understood looking backwards. Mm-hmm. And so I can look back on my career and see a logical, well, another professor said to me once, because early on I was trying to find, what will I do with my life? What what is my career? And the professor said to me, it was a pretty naive way of thinking about it, that a career is a job gives you opportunities. Those opportunities gives you skills and experiences, and those skills and experiences open new doors to new opportunities that give you new skills and experiences. And there it goes on. And so I can look back on my career and look at the different opportunities I had that gave you skills and experiences that then opened doors. And it was hardly linear. My career is, you know, anything but linear, and certainly for people who are running universities. But there's a logic to giving the best you can where you are and learning the most you can where you are. The other thing I suppose I've reflected on, and I think in these three organizations that I've run, I was not an employee at the time. I was brought in the outside to be the leader. And I think when you are recruiting someone to any role, it's really one of those great moments of trust. You know, why are we going to trust this person with this role, trust this person with this opportunity? And I think the thing that people actually pay a lot of attention to is, what did you do with the previous opportunities you have and you've had? And in looking at that, does it give them confidence to trust you with the new opportunity that emerges now? And so what I often say to students is, be great where you are, and more opportunities are likely to come to you, not because you're ambitious and not because you're always thinking about the next job or the next job, but with the opportunity that's in front of you right now. You work hard, you're collegial and collaborative, you're trying to be an important member of a team, you're trustworthy, you're reliable, you give it your all. And a combination of all those things mean that people have the confidence to perhaps give you more things down the track. But don't, you know, there could be far more interesting things that open up for you than you might have planned. So don't limit what they might be to your own imagination. I would have never imagined that I would have the opportunities that I've had. And if I'd settled for my ambitions, I would have sold myself well short from some of the opportunities that have come my way.
So my last question was, what advice would you give to the next generation of new academics? But in many respects, all those things that you've said for students would apply to those. But is there anything else that for the young, bright-eyed PhD graduate who wants to come into the university and make a difference, what advice would you give to them?
I think twofold. I think clearly disciplinary excellence is important. And so you've got to be able to throw yourself into a career and build a great track record of research and of teaching that makes you someone whose opinion is sought and whose writings are read and referenced, that students want to engage with, that postdocs want to come in and work with. So you've got to know that well. But I would always encourage academics as well to lift their sights, to lift their eyes beyond the sandstone walls of the institution, to be thinking ever more about where can they have impact and influence beyond the university. And even though, and that's not simply to be thinking around translation and commercialization, which are clearly very important parts of research and our research offering, but to just think through how we continue to build the license and to pay back the social capital that we have for, you know, we're not doing this work for us, we're doing this work for others, and to think through where those connections are and how you can demonstrate the service and the contribution of your work outside the university. I have a view that the future of universities are going to be in partnership. And certainly when it comes to the great global challenges that we face, they will not be solved by one discipline or one academic or group of academics working in one institution. It'll be often it will be multidisciplinary engagement. and teams of experts coming together from within a university and outside the university, and actually reaching into government and to business and research institutions and the nonprofit sector. So your ability to be great at your discipline, but to be great at partnership and great at working with others, and to be someone that others are desperate to work with, I think that's going to be an extraordinary career asset. And if I look at our, you know, some of our absolutely stellar academics, great disciplinary excellence, wonderful teams, but the world wants to work with them. And that's the key to success, I think.
Thank you for a most enjoyable conversation today. When I was working at Sydney as both a professor and pro-vice-chancellor of learning and teaching, I never imagined that I would be having a conversation with the vice-chancellor about reimagining higher education 20 years later. So, Mark, thank you for giving me your time, but also thank you for reinstating a sense of confidence and excitement in the field of higher education. So enjoy the rest of your day, and thank you for giving me your time.
Thanks very much, Judith. I've enjoyed the conversation.
You have been listening to Studiosity's podcast, Reimagining Higher Education, candid conversations within higher education, sharing stories of leadership, change, and best practice in teaching and learning. Visit studiosity.com.